Elijah is the most unusual yet highly respected sort of great uncle of the First Testament. He doesn't have many friends, and like most of the prophets, he's very much a loner, an intensely serious, holy man with the weight of the world on his shoulders. He isn't concerned about what other people think about him. He's not on a quest for popularity, fame, or stardom. Above all, Elijah is a man committed entirely to the service of God and faithfully conveying Yahweh's message to the Jewish people. Now that's the focus, the personality, the character of the man presented in the Hebrew Scriptures. But how many of the events recorded in the prophetic ministry of Elijah were based on factual, historical information? And if there were any embellishments or fabled additions, what was the message they attempted to convey to the descendants of Abraham? We must understand how ancient writers wrote. The word biography is composed of two Greek words, bios, which means life, and graphia, which means to write. So a biography is just the writings about a person's life. There's another word that we need to know when we read the stories of saints and kings and priests and holy men. It's a word we've talked about before, but I think it's important to remind us of the term hagiography. Once again, graphia means to write, and hagio is the Greek word for saints. But a hagiography is much more than just the writings about the life and events of saints. It is a style of writing that idealizes and, in a sense, idolizes its subject. In other words, these stories of priests, prophets, saints, and holy men in or out of the biblical literature, without any intent to deceive or mislead, often include exaggeration, literary embellishment, aggrandizement, which just means to make something or someone bigger than they really are in reputation and power, and hyperbole, which means to throw beyond. So it is, here's the situation, here's the story. We go beyond that. We add to it. We embellish it and enlarge it. Hagiographies are meant to honestly promote the greatness of the character in question in order to glorify and idolize the God behind the person. The logic goes like this. If Yahweh is all-powerful, just imagine what he can accomplish when he empowers his human servants to do his work. You may recall at one point in the ministry of Jesus, he was caught healing on the Sabbath, which technically was considered working on the Sabbath, at least at that time. And when confronted by the Jewish authorities, Jesus said in John 5:19-20, "Truly I tell you that the Son of God doesn't do anything by himself unless he sees the Father doing it. For whatever the Father does, the Son will also do. The Father loves the Son and shows him all he does, and to your amazement, he will show him even greater works than these that you see, these healings right now." And what Jesus was saying was that any amazement that you have, so there's the anger that you think I'm working on the Sabbath, but you're also jealous of what I can do, and you're thinking that I'm the one doing the healing, but whatever amazement you have over what you see me do, it is not for me. That glory, that worship, that sense of amazement, that amazement is supposed to bounce off of the man onto the God behind the man. And so Jesus was glorifying the Father by what he was doing. So some excellent examples of hagiographies, and I mentioned this one fairly recently, are stories such as St. Patrick driving all the snakes out of Ireland by the power of God. So to focus on the snakes, or even to focus on Patrick, completely misses the point of the story. The point was, Christianity came into Ireland and was extremely effective in converting the citizens there. Or St. Columba in the 7th century, who left Ireland to go across northern Scotland to try to Christianize the Scots. Good luck with that. Actually, he was very successful. But he was said to be a prolific worker of miracles, including raising the dead, calming wind and storms, and using a white stone from the riverbed to effect incredible cures. These were real individuals who had real ministries and were mightily aggrandized in the telling of their stories by embellishments of great deeds done by the power of God in and through them. So again, you could focus on the little white stone. Why did he use white stones? Why were they from the riverbed? Why not just use any stone? What did he do with the stone? And you completely miss the point of the story, which was there was a powerful, mighty God working behind the man and through the man to do great things. The account of the prophet Elijah, all of them are written in the style of a dynamic hagiography. So let's take a brief overview of the professional life of Elijah. Who was he? What did he do? Why is he famous? Why is he so important? Elijah is first mentioned in 1 Kings 17. Remember, this is a book that was written about 500 years before Jesus. This is not a book that was written like a journal or a catalog of events as they happen, and someone was recording the acts of the kings of Israel. This was written to kind of refresh, rejuvenate, and renew this nation of Israel who had just come out of captivity and had forgotten who they were. And these are the stories. These are the people that the authors of Kings said, remember back, or you may not have even known about this because many people would have been born in captivity and never even heard of these people. So they're rejuvenating their religion. And they're saying, there was a guy named Elijah and he did these things. And there was another guy called this. And there was a guy called Samson. And there was these individuals are part of our heritage. And it was all done with the intent of reminding people how powerful and how great their God was, and to return to that God. So Elijah is first mentioned in 1 Kings 17, where he proclaimed a drought and famine on the land as a penalty for the evil deeds of the kings of Israel. And there were lots of them. During this time, ravens brought him food, and he lived by a seasonal river until it dried up. In a famished and weakened state, Elijah believed he heard a voice from the Lord who told him to visit a widow in Zarephath for food and water. And once he arrived, her generously offering to feed him resulted in her own food source remaining constant. Her jar of flour and her jug of oil never ran dry. While he was staying there, the woman's son fell ill and died. Elijah pleaded with the Lord and stretched himself on top of the child exactly 3 times, restoring him to life. Elijah then presented himself to King Ahab, the evil King Ahab, telling him to summon the prophets of Baal and Asherah on Mount Carmel, along with all the people of Israel. So this is an Israelite king who is being challenged for his lack of true worship to Yahweh. And he's talking to a king who's worshiping and promoting the god Baal and Asherah. So Elijah confronted the people and told them that his God was mightier than theirs, not something people really want to hear. He said that if they prepared a sacrifice and called on Baal, then he would also prepare a sacrifice and call on the Lord. So you may recall this little battle of wills. So you've got two sacrifices to two different gods. And the challenge is that whichever one catches fire spontaneously, nobody's got a match here, but whoever could start their sacrificial pile on fire would prove to be the greater god. The worshippers of Baal prepared their sacrifice and called upon him from morning until noon, and no answer, no fire. Then Elijah rebuilt the altar of the Lord, prepared the sacrifice, and this time poured 4 jugs of water on it. So just to make sure that there was no accident, there was no spark in the area that suddenly caught fire, he doused the sacrifice in water to saturate it. And he called upon the Lord, and the Lord answered him. According to 1 Kings 18:38 to 39, it says, "The Lord's fire came down and devoured the burnt offering." Not just the offering. It devoured the wood. It devoured the stones and the dust. Do you see what I mean by hyperbole? It's like, okay, no, the stones didn't. You can't burn stones. But they're making it like the biggest of the biggest big thing they could possibly make bigger. And it devoured everything, and it even lapped up the water in the trench. And seeing this, all the people fell prostrate and said, "The Lord is God. The Lord is God, not Baal." After this, the prophets of Baal were seized and, of course, executed. When King Ahab told his wife Jezebel what Elijah had done, I'm sure he wasn't very happy, she vowed to kill him. And Elijah heard about this, and he was terrified. You would think, after just witnessing what you witnessed, that you've demonstrated that your God is mightier than their God, that you can ask God to do something like set a sacrifice on fire. Surely you can ask him to protect you from Jezebel. But these are very human people, and they're portrayed as weak and human for a reason, because we all have weaknesses. We all have times when we're insecure and uncertain. And so Elijah was terrified, and he ran away, fled to the desert, where he prayed for the Lord to take his life. I mean, he's running from Jezebel because he doesn't want to die. He runs into the desert and says, "God, just kill me. Better that I die by your hand instantly than by some kind of awful death that Jezebel and Ahab might want to conjure up for me." And then he fell asleep under a tree. This is another one of these themes that you see through the Old Testament. Jonah was another one. After running away from God, he has to do what he's told, but then he runs and hides under a tree. A messenger from the Lord came to Elijah twice, urging him to eat and drink. But he apparently didn't have much of an appetite when there's someone hunting to take your life. So he journeyed 40 days in the wilderness and came to Mount Horeb, where he hid in a cave. So he's hiding under a tree. They say, "Come on, you got to get out of this, snap out of it, get back, do your job, you're a prophet of God." He travels for 40 days, another interesting number. These are signals, that these have messages. There's so many instances where things happened in 40s or 40 days. And the voice of the Lord came to him in the cave and commanded him to get out. Stop hiding. Stand up on the mountain. And a violent wind came by, followed by an earthquake, then a fire. But the Lord was not in any of those. Instead, he spoke to Elijah in a quiet voice. And when he heard this, Elijah hid his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And a voice said to him, "Why are you here in the cave? You are a prophet of Israel. Why are you not prophesying? Why are you not out there with the people? Why are you hiding when you have me as your God?" And Elijah replied, and again, this is a very honest, I mean, think about who he's talking to here. He's talking to the creator of the universe, and he's kind of complaining to him, almost accusing him of being responsible for the situation he's in. He says, I have been zealous for you, the God of hosts, but the Israelites have forsaken your covenant. They have destroyed your altars and murdered your prophets by the sword, and now they want to take me and take my life. I am the last one left, and they're hunting me down. Why would I not hide under those circumstances? Wouldn't you, if you had the whole country hunting you down, and you had no friends, no one to turn to, no army, no protection? And the Lord said to him, go back. Take the desert road to Damascus. And when you arrive, that's up in the north in Syria, when you arrive there, you shall anoint Hazael as king of Aram. Aram is Syria. And you will anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, as king of Israel. And Elisha, son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, as prophet to succeed you. What's he doing? He's telling Elijah, who still has the spiritual authority in the country, the authority to anoint kings, to go and strategically anoint three individuals as the power base for what's about to happen. Anyone who escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. And anyone who escapes the sword of Hazael and Jehu, Elisha will kill. This is a cleansing of the nation. Things, the rot had gotten so bad in Israel with King Ahab. There was no redemption. There was no way to turn this around other than through purification. And then it says, I will spare 7,000 only in Israel. Every knee that is not bent to Baal, every mouth that has not kissed him, but every other Israelite citizen must be executed. It's a mass slaughter. After receiving these instructions, Elijah returned to civilization and recruited Elisha to minister with him. Soon after this, King Ahab died and was succeeded by his son Ahaziah. And after Ahaziah suffered an injury, I mean, we don't have a lot of people left. He sought the assistance, not of Yahweh, but of the God of Ekron, to see whether he would recover. Elijah confronted him. Don't you people ever learn? You cannot go to these other gods. And this made Ahaziah very, very angry. Who do you think you are, telling me, the king, what to do? In his rage, Ahaziah sent a captain with 50 men to kill one old prophet. Should be able to do the job, right? 50 trained soldiers to hunt down one robe-wearing, sandal-wearing, staff-carrying, old bearded prophet. Perhaps. He might have looked different. And in 2 Kings 1, verses 9 to 10, it says, the prophet was seated on a hilltop when the captain and his 50 men found him. All by himself. There he is, sitting on a hilltop, plain as day, hoping not to be found, but realizing probably that the end is coming. And the captain said to Elijah, man of God, the king commands you, come down, or come with us, back to the king. And Elijah answered the captain, well, if I am a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men. And fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50 men. Now, please, don't pretend you have never wished to have that power. Once in a while. Just a little bit of that. 5 minutes tops to take care of some nasty business. I certainly did when I heard this for the first time, thought, wow, if you could just say it, say the words. This happened a second time. The king sent another 50 men, And they were again struck down with fire. And when Elijah and Elisha traveled from Bethel to Jericho, after they crossed the Jordan, the country is purified. The prophets of Baal and the followers of Baal and Asherah are all dead now. All the enemies have been dealt with. And a new dawn, a new day is dawning, and Elijah is very old. And Elijah asked Elisha if there was anything that he could do for him before he was taken up to heaven. I don't know how he knew that's what he was going to do, what was going to happen, but that's the story anyway. And Elisha asked to be given a double portion of his spirit, of Elijah's spirit. So he wanted to be a prophet that could be twice as bold, twice as effective, twice as courageous. And Elijah said that that was a difficult request, but that it would come to pass if Elisha was able to witness Elijah when he was taken up. And then, and this has been made into movies and used in songs, a fiery chariot and horses came between them out of the sky, and Elisha saw a whirlwind take Elijah to heaven. Now bear in mind that heaven at the time of the writing of Kings was not what we think of heaven today. Heaven was simply the realm above the visible clouds. And anything that was not visible beyond the clouds was heaven. So if Elijah had seen a Boeing 767 flying through the air and then heading up and through the clouds, Elijah would have said, the plane has gone to heaven. So these are fantastical, supernatural, larger-than-life accounts. And even as a child, hearing these stories for the first time, I wondered, was Elijah really fed by birds in the Kereth Ravine east of Jordan during the famine in Israel? Was it true that the prophets Elijah and Elisha were just walking along, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a chariot of fire and horses appeared in the sky, separating the two of them, following which Elijah went up to the clouds in a whirlwind and was never seen from again. And in tradition, it was believed he never even died and is still there today, alive in his same form. Was it a natural whirlwind? Was it a perfectly natural phenomena that people have been sucked up by whirlwinds? Was it just a natural occurrence and it was interpreted as God taking him to heaven? Was it some kind of supernatural suction that could only best be described as like a whirlwind? Was whirlwind a metaphor for what happened when he died? We weren't there. We didn't see it. We can't answer that question. Did Elijah really wander in the wilderness for exactly 40 days? And who saw this? And who counted the days and recorded it? Did God really, in ancient times, really value, in this case, human life so little that he struck his enemies dead on the spot simply for worshiping the wrong God, when that was the only God they knew, even though Elijah was trying to win them over to his side? And why hasn't he ever done that since the time of the First Testament prophets? Why don't people today get zapped by fire if they're worshiping a pagan God? Okay, enough silliness. These sort of skeptical questions are futile because they completely miss the point of the author of Kings, of the Book of Kings. He's not telling you history. This is hagiography. This is fantastical literature intended to be historically based stories that drive the reader to celebrate the supremacy of Yahweh, along with the benefits of faithfulness to him and a dire warning of doom to those who are enemies of God and his chosen nation. Remember, it's not just the enemies of God, but it's the enemies of his people. It's a warning to anyone who will not support Israel, who will not befriend them. Okay, in closing, the life and ministry of Elijah can be summed up in the following seven lessons. And this is why the record of Elijah, and you can apply this to almost any prophet, this is the lesson we're supposed to learn. God, first of all, requires complete faithfulness. He wants our hearts, our devotion, our love far more than mere blind obedience. He will not tolerate part-time followers and those who are always wondering if there's another God, another faith system, another religious culture somewhere else that might be a bit more exciting or a bit easier to follow. Secondly, God is merciful and will almost always leave the front door open to those and to welcome those who repent and turn back to Him. Another common theme through the First Testament. Third, those outside of God's sons and daughters who aid and assist and support God's faithful servants, like the woman who fed Elijah, they will share in the blessings. Fourth, God is sometimes seen in the dramatic and the spectacular, in the fire, in the thunder, but He is just as present and just as dynamic when we are alone or in those times when God seems silent. Fifth, God does not jump to our timetable. Sometimes, even in the most dire situations, we are expected to be patient and wait. Sixth, God doesn't promise a trouble-free life. God sent ravens to Elijah not to prevent him from suffering the pains of hunger, but because he already was close to starvation and had for some time been in discomfort. And finally, number seven, no matter what circumstances are occurring in the chaotic and troublesome world around us, if we trust in Yahweh, He always will eventually provide for us.